Edward Foley Jr. was kicking ass up at Rensselaer Polytechnic in New York, and a starter on their hockey team, which damn near always kicked ass itself in the NCAA. Little Ed might earn a place on the Olympic team, though pro hockey was out. He'd make too much money as a computer engineer to waste his time in so pedestrian a pursuit.
I think we may have something here.
Like what, honey?
Like the executive secretary to Fang Gan, she replied. Nomori's trying to recruit her, and he says the prospects are good.
Genghis, Ed observed. They ought to have picked a different name, but unlike most CIA operations, the name for this one hadn't been generated by a computer in the basement. The fact of the matter was that this security measure hadn't been applied for the simple reason that nobody had ever expected anything to come of it. CIA had never gotten any kind of agent into the PRC government, at least not above the rank of captain in the People's Liberation Army. The problems were the usual ones. First, they had to recruit an ethnic Chinese, and CIA hadn't had much success at that. Next, the officer in question had to have perfect language skills and the ability to disappear into the culture. For a variety of reasons, none of that had ever happened. Then Mary Pat had suggested trying Nomori. His corporation did a lot of business in China, after all, and the kid did have good instincts. And so Ed Foley had signed off on it, not really expecting much to result. But again, his wife's field instincts had proven superior to his. It was widely believed that Mary Pat Foley was the best field officer the agency had had in 20 years, and it looked as if she was determined to prove that.
How exposed is Chet?
His wife had to nod her concern at that one.
He's hanging out there, but he knows how to be careful, and his communications gear is the best we have.
Unless they brute-force him, you know, just pick him up because they don't like his haircut, he ought to be pretty safe. Anyway, she handed over the communication from Beijing. The DCI read it 3 times before handing it back.
Well, if he wants to get laid, it's not good field craft, honey.
Not good to get that involved with your agent.
I know that, Ed. But you play the cards you're dealt, remember?
And if we get her a computer like the one Chet's using, her security won't be all that bad either, will it?
Unless they have somebody pick it apart, Ed Foley thought aloud.
Oh, Jesus, Ed, our best people would have a cast-iron motherfucker of a time figuring it all out. I ran that project myself, remember? It's safe.
Easy, honey.
The DCI held up his hand. When Mary used that sort of language, she was really into the matter at hand.
Yeah, I know, it's secure, but I'm the worrier and you're the cowgirl, remember?
Okay, honey bunny. The usual sweet smile that went with seduction and getting her way.
You've already told him to proceed?
He's my officer, Eddie.
A resigned nod. It wasn't fair that he had to work with his wife here. He rarely won any arguments at the office either.
Okay, baby, it's your operation. Run with it. But...
But what?
But we change Genghis to something else. If this one pans out, then we go to a monthly name cycle. This one has some serious implications, and we've got to go max security on it.
She had to agree with that. As case officers, the two of them had run an agent known in CIA legend as Cardinal, Colonel Mikhail Semyonovich Filitov, who'd worked inside the Kremlin for more than 30 years, feeding gold-plated information on every aspect of the Soviet military, plus some hugely valuable political intelligence. For bureaucratic reasons lost in the mists of time, Cardinal had not been handled as a regular agent in place. And that had saved him from Aldrich Ames and his treacherous betrayal of 12 Soviet citizens who'd worked for America. For Ames, it had worked out to roughly $100,000 per life given away. Both of the Foleys regretted the fact that Ames was allowed to live.
But they weren't in the law enforcement business.
Okay, Eddie, monthly change cycle. You're always so careful, honey.
You call or me?
We'll wait until she gives us something useful before going to all the trouble. But let's change Genghis to something else. It's too obviously a reference to China.
Okay.
An impish smile.
How about Zorga for the moment? She suggested.
The name was that of Richard Zorga, one of the greatest spies who'd ever lived, a German national who'd worked for the Soviets, and, just possibly, the man who'd kept Hitler from winning his Eastern Front war with Stalin. The Soviet dictator, knowing this, hadn't lifted a hand to save him from execution.
Gratitude, Yosef Vissarionovich had once said, is a disease of dogs.
The DCI nodded. His wife had a lively sense of humor, especially as applied to business matters.
When do you suppose we'll know if she'll play ball with us?
About as soon as Chet gets his rocks off, I suppose.
Mary, did you ever...
In the field?
Ed, that's a guy thing, not a girl thing, she told her husband with a sparkling grin as she lifted her papers and headed back out.
Except with you, honey bunny.
The Alitalia DC-10 touched down about 15 minutes early due to the favorable winds. Renato Cardinal Di Milo was pleased enough to think through an appropriate prayer of thanksgiving. A longtime member of the Vatican's diplomatic service, he was accustomed to long flights, but that wasn't quite the same as enjoying them. He wore his red, cardinal, and black suit that was actually more akin to an official uniform, and not a conspicuously comfortable one at that, despite the custom tailoring that came from one of Rome's better shops. One of the drawbacks to his clerical and diplomatic status was that he'd been unable to shed his suit coat for the flight. But he'd been able to kick off his shoes, only to find that his feet had swollen on the flight, and getting them back on was more difficult than usual. That evoked a sigh rather than a curse, as the plane taxied to the terminal. The senior flight attendant ushered him to the forward door and allowed him to leave the aircraft first. One advantage to his diplomatic status was that all he ever had to do was wave his diplomatic passport at the control officers, and in this case a senior PRC government official was there to greet him at the end of the jetway.
"Welcome to our country," the official said, extending his hand.
"It is my pleasure to be here," the cardinal replied, noting that this communist atheist didn't kiss his ring, as was the usual protocol.
Well, Catholicism in particular, and Christianity in general, were not exactly welcome in the People's Republic of China, were they? But if the PRC expected to live in the civilized world, then they'd have to accept representation with the Holy See. And that was that. And besides, he'd go to work on these people. And who knew, maybe he could convert one or two. Stranger things had happened. And the Roman Catholic Church had handled more formidable enemies than this one.
With a wave and a small escort group, the demi-minister conducted his distinguished visitor through the concourse toward the place where the official car and escort waited.
"How was your flight?" the underling asked.
"Lengthy, but not unpleasant," was the expected reply.
Diplomats had to act as though they loved flying, though even the flight crews found journeys of this length tiresome. It was his job to observe the new ambassador of the Vatican, to see how he acted, how he looked out the car's windows even, which in this case was not unlike all the other first-time diplomats who came to Beijing. They looked out at the differences. The shapes of the buildings were new and different to them, the color of the bricks, and how the brickwork looked close up and at a distance. The way in which things that were essentially the same became fascinating because of differences that were actually microscopic when viewed objectively. It took a total of 28 minutes to arrive at the residence/embassy.
It was an old building, dating back to the turn of the previous century, and had been the largish home of an American Methodist missionary, evidently one who liked his American comforts, the official thought, and had passed through several incarnations, including, he'd learned the previous day, that of a bordello in the diplomatic quarter in the 1920s and 30s, because diplomats liked their comforts as well. Ethnic Chinese, he wondered, or Russian women who'd always claimed to be of the Tsarist nobility. Or so he'd heard. After all, Westerners enjoyed fucking noble women for some reason or other, as if their body parts were different somehow. He'd heard that one, too, at the office, from one of the archivists who kept track of such things at the ministry. Chairman Mao's personal habits were not recorded, but his lifelong love for deflowering 12-year-olds was well known in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Every national leader had something odd and distasteful about him, the young official knew. Great men had great aberrations. The car pulled up to the old wooden frame house, where a uniformed policeman opened the door for the visiting Italian, and even saluted, earning himself a nod from the man wearing the ruby-red skullcap. Waiting on the porch was yet another foreigner, Monsignor Franz Shepka, whose diplomatic status was that of DCM, or Deputy Chief of Mission, which usually meant the person who was really in charge of things while the ambassador, mainly a man chosen for political reasons, reigned in the main office. They didn't know if that were the case here yet. Shepka looked as German as his ancestry was, tall and spare with gray-blue eyes that revealed nothing at all, and a wonderful language gift that had mastered not only the complex Chinese language, but also the local dialect and accent as well. Over the phone, this foreigner could pass for a party member, much to the surprise of local officials who were not in the least accustomed to foreigners who could even speak the language properly, much less master it. The German national, the Chinese official saw, kissed his superior's ring. Then the Italian shook his hand and embraced the younger churchman. They probably knew each other. Cardinal DeMillo then led Shepka to the escort and introduced them. They'd met many times before, of course, and that made the senior churchman appear just a little backward to the local official. In due course, the luggage was loaded into the residence-slash-embassy building, and the Chinese official got back in the official car for the ride to the foreign ministry, where he'd make his contact report. The papal nuncio was past his prime, he'd write. A pleasant enough old chap, perhaps, but no great intellect. A fairly typical Western ambassador, in other words. No sooner had they gotten inside than Shepka tapped his right ear and gestured around the building.
Everywhere? The cardinal asked.
Ja, doch, Monsignor Shepka replied in his native German, then shifted to Greek. Not modern, but Attic Greek, that spoken by Aristotle, similar to but different from the modern version of that language, a language perpetuated only by a handful of scholars at Oxford and a few more Western universities.
Welcome, Eminence. Even airplanes can take too long. Why can we not travel by ship? It would be a much gentler way of getting from point to point.
The curse of progress, the German priest offered weakly.
The Rome-Beijing flight was only 40 minutes longer than the one between Rome and New York, after all. But Renato was a man from a different and more patient age.
My escort, what can you tell me of him?
His name is Kian. He's 40, married, one son. He will be our point of contact with the foreign ministry. Bright, well-educated, but a dedicated communist.
Son of another such man, Shepka said, speaking rapidly in the language learned long before in seminary. He and his boss knew that this exchange would probably be recorded, and would then drive linguists in the foreign ministry to madness. Well, it was not their fault that such people were illiterate, was it?
And the building is fully wired, then? DeMillo asked,
heading over to a tray with a bottle of red wine on it.
"We must assume so," Shepka confirmed with a nod, while the Cardinal poured a glass.
"I could have the building swept, but finding reliable people here is not easy, and
those able to do a proper sweep would then use the opportunity to plant their own bugs for whatever country they worked for. America, Britain, France, Israel, all were interested in what the Vatican knew. The Vatican, located in central Rome, is technically an independent country. Hence Cardinal DeMillo's diplomatic status, even in a country where religious convictions were frowned upon at best, and stamped into the earth at worst. Renato Cardinal DeMillo had been a priest for just over 40 years, most of which time had been spent in the Vatican's foreign service. His language skills were not unknown within the confines of his own service, but rare even there, and damned rare in the outside world, where men and women took a great deal of time to learn languages. But DeMillo picked them up easily, so much so that it surprised him that others were unable to do so as well. In addition to being a priest, in addition to being a diplomat, DeMillo was also an intelligence officer. All ambassadors were supposed to be, but he was much more so than most. One of his jobs was to keep the Vatican, therefore the Pope, informed of what was happening in the world, so that the Vatican, therefore the Pope, could take action, or at least use influence in the proper direction. DeMillo knew the current Pope quite well. They'd been friends for years before his election to the chair of the Pontifex Maximus. Maximus, in this context, meaning chief, and Pontifex meaning bridge builder, as a cleric was supposed to be the bridge between men and their God. DeMillo had served the Vatican in this capacity in 7 countries. Before the fall of the Soviet Union, he'd specialized in Eastern European countries, where he'd learned to debate the merits of communism with its strongest adherents, mostly to their discomfort and his own amusement. Here would be different, the Cardinal thought. It wasn't just the Marxist beliefs. This was a very different culture. Confucius had defined the place of a Chinese citizen 2 millennia before, and that place was different from what Western culture taught. There was a place for the teachings of Christ here, of course, as there was everywhere. But the local soil was not as fertile for Christianity as it was elsewhere. Local citizens who sought out Christian missionaries would do so out of curiosity, and, once exposed to the gospel, would find Christian beliefs more curious still, since they were so different from the nation's more ancient teachings. Even the more normal beliefs that were in keeping, more or less, with Chinese traditions, like the Eastern spiritualist movement, known as Falun Gong, had been ruthlessly, if not viciously, repressed. Cardinal DeMillo told himself that he'd come to one of the few remaining pagan nations, and one in which martyrdom was still a possibility for the lucky or luckless, depending on one's point of view. He sipped his wine, trying to decide what time his body thought it was, as opposed to what time it was by his watch. In either case, the wine tasted good, reminding him, as it did, of his home, a place which he'd never truly left, even in Moscow or Prague. Beijing might be a challenge.
Chapter 8. Underlings and Underthings.
It wasn't the first time he'd done this. It was exciting in its way, and arousing, and marginally dangerous because of the time and place. Mainly it was an exercise in effective memory and the discerning eye. The hardest part was converting the English units to metric. The perfect female form was supposed to be 36-24-36, not 91.44, 60.96, 91.44. The last time he'd been in a place like this had been in the Beverly Center Mall in Los Angeles, buying for Maria Castillo,
a voluptuous Latina who'd been delighted at his error, taking her waist for 24 rather than its true 27. You wanted to err on the low side in numbers, but probably the big side in letters. If you took a 36B chest to be a 34C, she wouldn't be mad. But if you took a 24-inch waist for a 28-inch, she'd probably be pissed. Stress, Nomori told himself with a shake of the head, came in many shapes and sizes. He wanted to get this right because he wanted Ming as a source. But he wanted her as a mistress, too. And that was one more reason not to make a mistake. The color was the easy part. Red. Of course, red. This was still a country in which red was the good color, which was convenient because red had always been the lively choice in women's underthings, the color of adventure and giggles and looseness. And looseness served both his biological and professional purposes. He had other things to figure out, too. Ming was not tall, scarcely 5 feet, 151 centimeters or so, Nomori thought, doing the conversion in his head. She was short, but not really petite. There was no real obesity in China. People didn't overeat here, probably because of the lingering memory of times when food had not been in abundance, and overeating was simply not possible. Ming would have been considered overweight in California, Chester thought, but that was just her body type. She was squat because she was short, and no amount of dieting or working out or makeup could change it. Her waist wouldn't be much less than 27 inches. For her chest, 34B was about the best he could hope for. Well, maybe 34C. No, he decided. B-plus at most. So a 34B bra and medium shorts, panties, red silk, something feminine. Something on the wild, whorish side of feminine. Something that she could look into the mirror alone with and giggle. And maybe sigh at how different she looked wearing such things. And maybe smile. That special inward smile women had for such moments. The moment when you knew you had them. And the rest was just dessert. The best part of Victoria's Secret was the catalog, designed for men who really and sensibly wanted to buy the models themselves, despite the facial attitudes that sometimes made them look like lesbians on Quaaludes. But with such bodies, a man couldn't have everything, could he? Fantasies. Things of the mind. Nomori wondered if the models really existed or were the products of computers. They could do anything with computers these days. Make Rosie O'Donnell into Twiggy. Or Cindy Crawford obsolete. Back to work, he told himself. This might be a place for fantasies, but not that one. Not yet. Okay, it had to be sexy. It had to be something that would both amuse and excite Ming, and himself, too. That was all part of it. Nomori took the catalog off the pile because it was a lot easier for him to see what he wanted in a filled rather than an unfilled condition. He turned pages and stopped dead on page 26. There was a black girl modeling it, and whatever genetic stew she'd come from must have had some fine ingredients, as her face would have appealed to a member of Hitler's SS just as much as Idi Amin. It was that sort of face. Better yet, she wore something called a racerback bra with matching string bikini panties, and the color was just perfect, a red-purple that the Romans had once called Tyrian scarlet, the color on the toga stripe of members of the senatorial order, reserved by price and custom to the richest of the Roman nobility, not quite red, not quite purple. The bra material was satin and lycra, and it closed in front, the easier for a girl to put it on, and the more interesting for a guy to take it off, his mind thought, as he headed over to the proper rack of clothing. 34B, he thought. If too small, it would be all the more flattering. Small or medium on the string bikini.
Shit, he decided. Get one of each. Just to be sure, he also got a no-wire triangle pattern bra and thong panties in an orange-red color that the Catholic Church would call a mortal sin just for looking at. On impulse, he got several additional panties on the assumption that they soiled more quickly than bras did, something he wasn't sure of despite being a field intelligence officer of the Central Intelligence Agency. They didn't tell you about such things at the farm. He'd have to do a memo on that. It might give MP a chuckle in her seventh-floor office at Langley. One other thing, he thought, perfume. Women liked perfume. You'd expect them to like it, especially here. The entire city of Beijing smelled like a steel mill, lots of coal dust and other pollutants in the air, as Pittsburgh had probably been at the turn of the last century. And the sad truth was that the Chinese didn't bathe as diligently as Californians did, and nowhere nearly as regularly as the Japanese. So, something that smelled nice. Dream Angels, the brand was called. It came in a perfume spray, lotion, and other applications that he didn't understand. But he was sure Ming would, since she was a girl, and this was a quintessential girl thing. So he bought some of that, too, using his NEC credit card to pay for it. His Japanese bosses would understand. There were skillfully arranged and choreographed sex tours that took Japanese salarymen to various places in Asia that catered to the sex trade. That was probably how AIDS had gotten to Japan, and why Nomura used a condom for everything there except urinating. The total came to about 300 euros. The sales clerk wrapped everything and commented that the lady in his life was very lucky. She will be. Nomura promised himself. The underthings he'd just bought her, well, the fabrics felt as smooth as flexible glass, and the colors would arouse a blind man. The only question was how they would affect a dumpy Chinese female secretary to a government minister. It wasn't as though he was trying to seduce Susie Wong. Lian Ming was pretty ordinary rather than ordinarily pretty. But you never knew. Amy Irvin, his first conquest at the ripe old age of 17 years and 3 months, had been pretty enough to inspire him, which meant, for a boy of that age, she had the requisite body parts, no beard like a Civil War general, and had showered in the previous month. At least Ming wouldn't be like so many American women now who'd visited the plastic surgeon to have their tummies tucked, tits augmented to look like cereal bowls, and lips pumped full of chemicals until they looked like some strange kind of two-part fruit. What women did to attract men, and what men did in the hope of seducing them. What a potential energy source, Nomura thought, as he turned the key in his company Nissan.
"What is it today, Ben?" Ryan asked his national security advisor.
CIA is trying to get a new operation underway in Beijing. For the moment, it's called Zorga.
As in Richard Zorga?
Correct.
Somebody must be ambitious.
Okay, tell me about it. There's an officer named Chester Nomura, an illegal. He's in Beijing, covered as a computer salesman for NEC. He's trying to make a move on a secretary, female, for a senior PRC minister, a guy named Fang Gan.
Who is? Ryan asked over his coffee mug.
Sort of a minister without portfolio, works with the premier and the foreign minister.
Like that Zhang Hansan guy?
Not a senior, but yes. Looks like a very high-level gopher type. Has contacts in their military and foreign ministries. Good ideological credentials, sounding board for others in their Politburo. Anyway, Nomura is trying to make a move on the girl.
Bond, Ryan observed in a studiously neutral voice. James Bond.
I know Nomura's name. He did some good work for us in Japan when I had your job. This is for information only, not my approval.
Correct, Mr. President. Mrs. Foley is running this one, and wanted to give you a heads up.
Okay, tell MP that I'm interested in whatever take comes out of this.
Ryan fought off the grimace that came from learning of another person's private, well, if not private, then his sex life.
Yes, sir.
Chapter 9. Initial Results. Chester Nomori had learned many things in his life, from his parents and his teachers and his instructors at the farm. But one lesson he'd yet to learn was the value of patience, at least as it applied to his personal life. That didn't keep him from being cautious, however. That was why he'd sent his plans to Langley. It was embarrassing to have to inform a woman of his proposed sex life. MP was a brilliant field spook, but she still took her leaks sitting down, Nomori reminded himself. But he didn't want the agency to think that he was an alley cat on the government payroll, because the truth was he liked his job. The excitement was at least as addictive as the cocaine that some of his college chums had played with. Maybe that's why Mrs. Foley liked him, Nomori speculated. They were of a kind. Mary Pat, they said in the Directorate of Operations, was the cowgirl. She'd swaggered through the streets of Moscow during the last days of the Cold War like Annie fucking Oakley packing heat. And though she'd been burned by KGB's second chief directorate, she hadn't given the fuckers anything. And whatever operation she'd run, this was still very, very secret, it must have been a son of a bitch, because she'd never gone back in the field but had scampered up the CIA career ladder like a hungry squirrel up an oak tree. The president thought she was smart, and if you wanted a friend in this business, the president of the United States was right up there, because he knew the spook business. Then came the stories about what President Ryan had once done. Bringing out the chairman of the fucking KGB? MP must have been part of that, the boys and girls of the DO all thought. All they knew, even within the confines of CIA, except, of course, for those who needed to know, both of them, the saying went, was what had been published in the press. And while the media generally knew jack shit about black operations, a CNN TV crew had put a camera in the face of a former KGB chairman now living in Winchester, Virginia. While he hadn't spilled many beans, the face of a man the Soviet government had declared dead in a plane crash was bean enough to make a very rich soup indeed. Nomori figured he was working for a couple of real pros, and so he let them know what he was up to, even if that meant causing a possible blush for Mary Patricia Foley, Deputy Director, Operations, of the Central Intelligence Agency. He'd picked a Western-style restaurant. There were more than a few of them in Beijing now, catering both to the locals and to tourists who felt nostalgic for the taste of home, or who worried about their GI systems over here. Not unreasonably, Nomori thought. The quality wasn't anything close to a real American restaurant, but it was considerably more appealing than the deep-fried rat he suspected was on the menu of many Beijing eateries. He'd arrived first and was relaxing with a cheap American bourbon when Ming came through the door. Nomori waved in what he hoped was not an overly boyish way. She saw him do so, and her resulting smile was just about right, he thought. Ming was glad to see him, and that was step one in the plan for the evening. She made her way to his corner table in the back. He stood, showing a degree of gentlemanliness unusual in China, where women were nowhere near as valued as they were back home. Nomori wondered if that would change. If all the killing of female babies could suddenly make Ming a valuable commodity, despite her plainness. He still couldn't get over the casual killing of children. He kept it in the front of his mind, just to keep clear who the good guys were in the world, and who the bad guys were. "It's so good to see you," he said with an engaging smile. "I was worried you might not meet me here."
"Oh, really? Why?"
"Well, your superior at work. I'm sure that he
Well, need you, I suppose, is the polite way to put it, Nomori said with a hesitant voice, delivering his rehearsed line pretty well, he thought. He had. The girl giggled a little.
Comrade Fang is over 65, she said. He is a good man, a good superior, and a fine minister, but he works long hours and he is no longer a young man.
Okay, so he fucks you, but not all that much, Nomori interpreted that to mean. And maybe you'd like a little more from somebody closer to your age, eh? Of course, if Fang was over 65 and still getting it on, then maybe he is worthy of some respect, Nomori added to himself, then tossed the thought aside. Have you eaten here before? The place was called Vincenzo's, and pretended to be Italian. In fact, the owner-operator was a half-breed Italian-Chinese from Vancouver, who spoke an Italian would have gotten him hit by the mafia had he tried it in Palermo, or even Mulberry Street in Manhattan. But here in Beijing it seemed genuinely ethnic enough.
No,
Ming replied, looking around at, to her, this most exotic of locations. Every table had an old wine bottle, its bottom wrapped in twine, and an old drippy red candle at the top. The tablecloth was checked white and red. Whoever had decorated this place had evidently seen too many old movies. That said, it didn't look anything like a local restaurant, even with the Chinese servers. Dark wood paneling, hooks near the door for hanging coats. It could have been in any East Coast city in America, where it would have been recognized as one of those old family Italian places, a mom-and-pop joint with good food and little flash.
What is Italian food like?
At its best, Italian cooking is among the very finest in the world, Nomori answered. You've never had Italian food? Never at all? Then may I select for you? Her response was girlish in its charm. Women were all the same. Treat them in the right way, and they turn into wax in your hand, to be kneaded and shaped to your will. Nomori was starting to like this part of the job, and some day it might be useful in his personal life, too. He waved to the waiter, who came over with a subservient smile. Nomori, first of all, ordered a genuine Italian white wine. Strangely, the wine list here was actually first rate, and quite pricey to boot, of course. And, with a deep breath, fettuccine Alfredo, quintessential Italian heart attack food. From looking at Ming, he figured that she'd not refuse rich food. So, the new computer and printer systems continue to work out?
Yes, and Minister Fang has praised me before the rest of the staff for choosing it. You have made me something of a hero, Comrade Nomori.
I am pleased to hear that, the CIA officer replied, wondering if being called comrade was a good thing for the current mission or a bad one. We are bringing out a new portable computer now, one you could take home with you, but which has the same power as your office mainframe. With all the same features and software, of course, even a modem for accessing the Internet.
Really? I get to do that so seldom. At work, you see, it is not encouraged for us to surf the net, except when the minister wants something specific.
Is that so? What net interests does Minister Fang have?
Mainly political commentary, and mainly in America and Europe. Every morning I print up various pieces from the newspapers, the Times of London, New York Times, Washington Post, and so on. The minister especially likes to see what the Americans are thinking.
Not very much, Nomori observed as the wine arrived.
Excuse me?
Ming asked, getting him to turn back.
Hmm?
Oh, the Americans, they don't think very much. The shallowest people I have ever encountered. Loud, poorly educated, and they're women. Chet let his voice trail off.
What of their women, Comrade Nomori? Ming asked, virtually on command.
Ah. He took a sip of the wine and nodded for the waiter to serve it properly. It was a pretty good one from Tuscany. Have you ever seen the American toy, the Barbie doll?
Yes, they are made here in China, aren't they?
That is what every American woman wishes to be. Hugely tall, with massive bosoms, a waist you can put your hands around. That is not a woman. It's a toy, a mannequin for children to play with. And about as intelligent as your average American woman. Do you think they have language skills as you do? Consider, we now converse in English, a language native to neither of us, but we converse well, do we not?
Yes,
Ming agreed. How many Americans speak Mandarin, do you suppose? Or Japanese? No, Americans have no education, no sophistication. They are a backward nation, and their women are very backward. They even go to surgeons to have their bosoms made bigger, like that stupid child's doll. It's comical to see them, especially to see them nude, he concluded with a dangle.
You have?
She asked, on cue.
Have what?
You mean, seen American women nude? He got a welcome nod for his question. This was going well. Yes, Ming, I am a man of the world. Yes, I have. I lived there for some months, and it was interesting in a grotesque sort of way. Some of them can be very sweet, but not like a decent Asian woman with proper proportions, and womanly hair that doesn't come from some cosmetics bottle. And manners. Americans lack the manners of an Asian.
But there are many of our people over there.
Didn't you meet one? No, the Round Eyes keep them for themselves. I suppose their men appreciate real women, even while their own women turn into something else. He reached to pour some more wine into Ming's glass. But in fairness, there are some things Americans are good at.
Such as? She asked.
The wine was already loosening her tongue. I will show you later. Perhaps I owe you an apology, but I have taken the liberty of buying you some American things.
Really?
Excitement in her eyes. This was really going well, Nomori told himself. He'd have to go easier on the wine. Well, half a bottle, two of these glasses wouldn't hurt him in any way. How did that song go? It's okay to do it on the first date. Well, he didn't have to worry about much in the way of religious convictions or inhibitions here, did he? That was one advantage to communism, wasn't it? The fettuccine arrived right on time, and surprisingly it was pretty good. He watched her eyes as she took her first forkful. Vincenzo's used silverware instead of chopsticks, which was a better idea for fettuccine Alfredo anyway. Her dark eyes were wide as the noodles entered her mouth.
This is fine. Lots of eggs have gone into it. I love eggs, she confided.
They're your arteries, honey, the case officer thought. He watched her inhale the first bit of the fettuccine. Nomori reached across the table to top off her wine glass once more. She scarcely noticed. She attacked her pasta so furiously. Halfway through the plate of pasta, she looked up.
I have never had so fine a dinner, Ming told him.
Nomori responded with a warm grin. I am so pleased that you are enjoying yourself. Wait till you see the drawers I just got you, honey. Attention to orders!